Good afternoon, and welcome to the hashtag MoEdge podcast. I am Alicia Scher, a reporter with the Missouri Times, and I am filling in for Rachel Dunn today. Here on the hashtag MoEdge podcast, we are joined by a very special guest who was recently voted by his peers to the number two position within the House Republican Caucus, Representative John Wieman. Welcome, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Alicia. This is kind of weird to hear that title, but it's been an honor to be selected by my peers to serve in that position.
Okay, so for those of us who don't know a lot about you, what's your background? Where did you come from?
Okay, well, I am born and raised in Missouri. I was actually born in St. Louis, but was raised about 100 miles west of St. Louis in a small town, St. James, Missouri. That's where I grew up, Phelps County area, close to Rolla. And I grew up actually in the country. Most people don't know that. They all think I'm a city slicker. I live in the St. Louis area. But spent my first 18 years living in St. James, Missouri. Went to a public school there and played sports, was involved in, you know, basketball and golf, and just did all kinds of things. I was a lifeguard at the local pool, and my parents had a business. My dad owned a electrical and plumbing business at first, and then later on he started up a nursing home for developmentally disabled, and they've had that business for over 40 years. And so I kind of grew up around the long-term care industry and helping out people with disabilities. And then from there, I went on to college. I actually went to junior college for 2 years at East Central Missouri, East Central College in Union, Missouri, and was there studying business. And then from there, went on to University of Missouri, Columbia, and finished up my bachelor's degree in business administration, and then stayed there for a few more years and worked part-time. And I actually worked for Roy Blunt, for Secretary of State, for a couple years, and was still going to school part-time, and then finally finished up my master's degree in healthcare administration in 94, and then from there went out into the real world and started working. But when I was going to East Central College during the summer, I actually met my wife there at East Central College. Yeah, I met her there in Union, Missouri, and we were taking two summer classes together, and we happened to have the same summer classes.
Must be fate.
Yeah, she locked down on to me right away, and the rest is history. We got married right after she graduated from college, and we got married. We've been married for 28 years now. It's hard to believe.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Two kids later, and so.
Any grandkids?
No. My kids are not that old yet, so I have a 20-year-old, soon to be 21-year-old at Mizzou. Okay. And then I have a 17-year-old son, so they've been given strict instructions. They're to be good gentlemen and focus on school and let the rest take its course, normal course.
Let the rest be history.
That's right.
So, how did you get into politics?
You know, like a lot of people, it's your parents have a lot of influences on you as you grow up. And one of the things that my parents were involved with was the Republican Party in our local area. My mother and my father were both on the Republican Central Committee in Phelps County. And they used to take me when I was a kid. They used to take me to Lincoln Day dinners, which is kind of a Republican, you know, usually around February, March. There's a lot of Lincoln Day dinners around the state. And so I used to go to those Lincoln Day dinners, and I was really impressed by the various elected officials that would come and speak. And from there, I just got interested and started working on campaigns when I was 17. Started working on campaigns. I actually worked on Margaret Kelly's campaign. She was the auditor at the time, or was running for auditor, and I worked on her campaign for a little bit. And then went to Boise State. So that kind of even further, you know, cemented my interest into politics, and then from there I just kept staying involved and was, you know, working for candidates. Worked for Roy Blunt, like I said, for a couple years when he ran for governor, and worked on congressional campaigns. I worked on a presidential campaign. So I mean, I've been involved in some form or fashion helping people get elected, or, you know, I didn't really start running for office until, you know, 4 years ago.
How young were you for your first Lincoln days?
I'd say probably 12 or 13 years old.
And it was interesting?
Oh, yeah.
That young?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, my father and I, we'd sit around the TV in the morning and we'd watch the news. And so I've been debating and talking about politics and, you know, public policy since I was a very young man, just because of my father and his exposure to me about things that are going out in the world. So this is kind of in my blood, I guess, at that point.
I know a lot of people say that it's hard to get young people interested in politics, but you're the exception to the rule.
Yeah, I honestly tell people a lot that the best way to get young people involved is to expose them to it. Expose them to it, because if they're not exposed to the political process, they don't know any better. And so I always encourage, especially older people that have kids or grandkids, I'm like, take your kids and your grandkids, make them come with you to a political event, and preferably one that's somewhat fun to go to. I mean, a Lincoln Day dinner is usually pretty fun. It involves food and there's a relatively amount of entertainment there. But that's the first thing, is just expose them to it. I think that's the key, is just getting kids, young people involved in the political process early on, and show them that this is important and it's exciting. It can be exciting.
So are your kids interested in politics?
I think my oldest one is. My youngest one, I haven't seen him show a lot of interest yet, but, you know, he's 17. He's still in high school, has a girlfriend, so he has other distractions. but my oldest is definitely interested. He's definitely has shown some desire to want to look at and do things in the political realm. So I'm 50% right now.
50 for 50.
Yeah.
That's not bad odds.
Yeah.
So why run for office?
Well, you know what? I have always had the desire to want to serve. And so that's one of the things, once again, that my parents had that influence on me when I was a young person. My dad was involved in his community. He served on, I was in various civic clubs and was always trying to help his community out. And so I observed that. That was something I just kind of figured that's what you do. And so, you know, when I got older and started getting involved in politics, that I kind of figured that that'd be something I would do eventually. I didn't know when that would happen. It may not be, you know, immediately, but I made the decision that I wanted to kind of get my life settled first before I decided to make that commitment to run for public office. So hence, that's why I didn't run until I was in my mid-40s. I waited until I had my kids were old enough. I didn't feel like I was going to be away from them when they were real, real young. My career was established. You know, just wanted to make sure I had as much as I had in place before I decided to make that commitment to run for public office and to serve. So, but my ultimate desire is to serve my community and try to help those that are in need and try to make our state better. That's ultimately why I wanted to serve.
And your family was supportive?
Absolutely. I think you have to have that from day one. And it was funny. I always tell my wife, and I always kind of tell people the story, is that when we first met, actually when we got married, my dad was running for state senate in 1990. I was running his campaign, and I got married that same year. And so she got indoctrinated right away into, okay, this is what the, you know, it's going to be like.
A lot
and
of craziness all
yeah,
the
it was. And so, you know, she was out there, my wife Yvette was out there on the campaign trail with us, you know, in 1990, and she got exposed to it right away. But I told her from the very beginning when I first met her, I said, hey, I like politics, and I used to take her with me to a lot of political events, and her family was not involved in politics. They were very, you know, like the average family. They didn't do political things. And so anyway, I told her, I said, hey, I'm going to probably someday either run for office, or I'm going to be very involved in politics. And so I need you to be aware of this up front. If you want to get married, that this is something I may want to do. And so she knew from the very beginning that that's something I wanted to do. And she agreed to that. And so she's kept her end of the bargain. So everything's good.
What'd the kids think?
I think they enjoy it. Although my youngest son that's in high school right now, he got a little nervous whenever I put up my campaign sign, especially when it was right next to his high school. So he got a lot of grief from his friends about about my campaign signs being up all over the place. So it's a little embarrassing to him, I guess. But you know how kids are.
Anything will embarrass a teenager.
Well, then, and then this year, interesting enough, this year, really the first time I've ever done it, I actually did a digital campaign. Part of my campaign was to do some digital ads. And so apparently they were showing up at school. When they use their computer labs or whatever, they were able to pull up YouTube or something, and it was pulling up my ads. And so he'd come home and say, "Dad, your video, your digital ads are on the or showing up in school." So it was kind of funny.
Stories to come home
yeah,
with.
Yeah, that's right.
So you just won the race within your caucus for Speaker Pro Tem. Will you go through that for me?
Yeah, that process, and I don't know, most people don't really know how that works, but, you know, the Republican caucus, just like the Democratic caucus, they will elect their officers, their leadership, every 2 years, typically. And, you know, we have a speaker pro tem, you have caucus chair, you have a floor leader, assistant floor leader. I mean, there's quite a few leadership positions to fill.
There's quite a few Republicans,
116 of us. And so, you know, that process actually to run for that leadership position really, really should start, in my mind, at least a year to 2 years before you're interested in running, you know, because you're basically, it's like high school. You're running for high school class president. It's to a certain extent, it's a who knows you, and it's kind of a whether you've made a point to get to know everybody. And it's a process that takes more than just, you know, 3 months. You have to start early building those relationships with your fellow caucus members, letting them know that you're interested in running for leadership, and then they have to feel comfortable to want to support you. And so when I chose to run, I started over a year ago actively kind of putting the word out there that I was going to run for leadership and started asking for support. And then, of course, throughout the summer, started making the visits, driving around the state, which, you know, it's a lot of time and energy to do that, but I think it's absolutely critical that you get out and meet with your fellow caucus members and let them know that you're interested in their concerns and interested in learning about what they want to get accomplished, and ultimately then they make the decision. They vote whether they agree with you or not. They're going to vote for the person they believe is going to do the best for the caucus.
And they voted for you.
And they voted for me. Obviously. And there was, and this point, you know, a caucus leadership election is similar like a primary. You know, sometimes it's a little ugly, but I will say that it was not that way in my race. Both the other two gentlemen that ran for that position were class acts individuals. They didn't, you know, we didn't say anything negative about each other. Kept it clean. Talked about what we were going to do. And after the election was over with, we all shook hands, and you know, you have to get over that as quickly as possible, because sometimes it can be a little contentious, you know. But eventually, you know, you have to realize that you have to let that go and move forward and try to be one united family.
You're all on the same team.
We're all on the same team.
Obviously, here at the Hashtag MoLedge podcast, we have a sweet spot for policy. So what are some bills you think you might support going into to the 2019 general session?
I generally support legislation that deals with less government, less regulation, less taxes. I'm usually less is better. That's generally what I like and support. My voting record's been typically pretty conservative. If you've seen my voting record, it's usually I'm usually on the conservative side, but I'm also realistic too. There's some bills that, you know, we have to pass, because even though it may, you know, may increase a fee here or increase a tax here, but may lower taxes here, it all balances out. But I think some of the things that I'm looking forward to supporting next year will be bills related to workforce development. I think that's a huge issue. I know the governor is very interested in us moving forward with workforce development type legislation, and then that's something that we can do in the state of Missouri to help improve our work environment, to make businesses be able to continue to grow and expand. Another area I think that's important is continuing with along the lines of regulatory reform. I actually sponsored a bill last year. Not sure if I'll sponsor that same bill this year. I may have someone else do that, but I'll certainly support it. And that's just trying to, my idea was, is you can't really stop the government bureaucracy from creating new rules, promulgating rules. But if we can slow them down, in other words, put some speed bumps out there for them to say, hey, we want to do this, we want to come up with this new rule, well, we got to jump through a few more hoops before we can make this rule go into effect. That at least maybe slow them down so they're not passing so many new rules every year. That's something I'd like to see get done to where we really kind of slow down the creation of new rules and then work on trying to get rid of old rules if we can that are outdated or ones that are just very cumbersome to business. And then another area that I'm very passionate about is transparency. Transparency, one of the bills I carried, and I plan on carrying it this coming session, will be dealing with municipal transparency. And I don't know if you're familiar with that particular bill, but that bill basically said, because see, right now, you know, the state of Missouri, we have an accountability portal where you can go online, you can look up just pretty much anything.
Yeah.
You can't do that for cities. Now, there are some cities, some large cities have it online. They'll have their finances online. You can go and look up and find out where the money's being spent or where it's coming from, who's being paid what. But most of the cities in this state do not have that type of information online and readily available. So you in the media, if you want to get information from a city, you can put in a request, you know, freedom of information or sunshine request, whatever. And depending on the city, they may say, well, we'll get that back to you within a day, or we might get back to you in 30 days, or it might take us 6 months to get you that information. Oh, it's going to cost you $15,000. Or, I mean, it's crazy what some of these municipalities have done to try to slow down or prevent people from getting that information. So all I'm asking is that we want to have some platform that we can help the cities, and I emphasize the word help the cities. It's not a mandate, but to help them with providing that information to the public so that way we can all see where the money is being spent and where it's being received. So transparency.
Yeah. Speaking of transparency, the governor, the Office of Administration has recently just launched, there's the Show Me Checkbook website.
Yeah.
And
same exact concept. It just would be for the municipalities. Now, the reason why I chose just municipalities and not the counties and not the school districts and all the rest is because sometimes it's best to, you know, the best way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time. And if for us to try to do transparency right away on the first go around, to just have everybody be included in that, the schools and the counties and stuff, would be a pretty big undertaking. And so we thought it would be best to just go after the cities first, have them get that information online towards readily available, and then from there kind of learn from that process and then roll in the counties and roll in the other political, quasi-political organizations into that portal.
So workforce development is something that's certainly been a priority of the new governor. So what does that look like in terms of legislation?
Well, I'll give you an example. It doesn't necessarily have to be legislation. It could be spending. For example, in my district, there's a community college, St. Charles Community College. They're working to expand workforce development and workforce training out in Warren County. And right now, they need money to be able, seed money to be able to build the facility to have, you know, to be able to have classes and start doing the training, and it's $5 million. So that's a budgetary thing that we could allocate that in the budget that could help workforce development. Other things that involve workforce development really is just providing more opportunities for school districts and other institutions to provide more opportunities for kids to get in and get that training. Right now, what I'm hearing is that sometimes there's only limited space. You may only have, for our school district, they may only have maybe say, I'm just doing a hypothetical number, but they may say they only have 10 slots, but they may have 30 kids that want to do it, but only have 10 slots. So we need to expand the capacity for that training And then once we do that, we'll have a larger, more able workforce. And that's really the problem right now. We have a lot of businesses because the economy is doing well. A lot of companies, manufacturing companies. I mean, welders, for example. I mean, you know what the starting salary is for a lot of those guys? I mean, it's like $40,000, $50,000, and it can get up to $60,000, $70,000 for a welder, you know, a very, you know, well-trained welder. But who's training those people? And then the other thing we have to do, and this is more of an educational thing, but we need to start encouraging young people to consider the trades. You know, it used to be when I was a kid, you know, pretty much you were going to go to college. That was what you had to do. My dad was an electrician. He learned a skill. He had a trade, and made a very good living at it. And we need those type of skill sets. But when back generational wise, that was not what we were told as kids. That we were told, hey, you need to go to college if you want to be somebody. You make a lot of money. And that's not necessarily the case anymore. And we need to start encouraging kids to go where they're going to get the best fit for their lifestyle and what they like to do. And I think that's what we need to work on as well.
I remember in my high school, a lot of the trades or vocational stuff that you learned, you actually learned through your FFA classes.
Mm-hmm.
You learned welding.
Yeah. Well, we had in a lot of schools, my school, my little small little public school that I went to in St. James, we had a shop class. Everybody had to take a shop class. And now a lot of these schools don't even have shop classes anymore. So you're not even getting exposed to it. And, you know, some of them have created their own little private, you know, not private, but they've created their own separate schools that are for, I don't know what they call it. It's some kind of a workforce development type program, like that for those kids that don't want to go to college, they can go there and get some training. But once again, like I said, there's limited slots available for those kids, and a lot of them, you know, when they get out of high school, their option is, well, I guess I'll go sign up, you know, to go into the armed forces or try to go get on work for some manufacturing plant and get training on the job, that's done a lot too. But you know, we gotta if we can get these kids to a point where they're trained earlier, and they're coming into the workforce at a higher level, it's gonna be better for all those involved.
Yeah. So, do those priorities fall in line with the caucuses for next session, or?
I believe so. I mean, you know, we're always, every year it's kind of the same old thing. We typically deal with, we're dealing with funding issues. We're dealing with how do we find the money to increase funding, like we've done every year since I've been in the legislature. We've increased the funding for Department of Education's secondary department, or DESE basically. Fully funding the foundation formula, making sure we have more money going to the schools. So the schools is always an issue. Education is always an issue that we deal with every year, depending on what the specific topic is. I imagine next year might be some discussion about funding for transportation for schools. That's probably going to be an issue education-wise that the caucus will be working on. But the caucus generally works on the same things. We're working on, you know, less taxes, you know, less government, you know, better funding for our schools, or better, you know, school reform. I'm sure there's going to be some school reform issues that'll be like we do every year. Transportation infrastructure is another one. We didn't pass the tax, so we're going to have to deal with that. We're going to have to figure out where we can find some additional revenue to help fund, you know, better roads. But that's something that's been around for eons. I remember when my dad ran for state senate in 1990, I went with him to meet with the Missouri Press Association. They had an office in Columbia. And it was so funny. The guy, it was an old crusty old sales guy, gets out the book, this big book, and it was a picture photo album. And he started flipping over and showing ads of old politicians from like back in the 40s and the 50s, or even farther back than that. And I started flipping through and looking at them, and I'm thinking, oh, better roads, better schools. These issues never change. They stay the same. You know, they might be a little minor nuances to them, but the bottom line is that's what we're always working on. We're always working on better schools. We're always working on better roads, you know, lower crime. And nothing really changes. It's just that, sometimes little minor changes. But so I suspect we'll be doing the same things that we've been doing for the last 100 years in this state, trying to make our state better by making roads better, making schools better, you know.
So I have 3 quick fun questions for you.
This is scary.
Okay. So you're stranded on a desert island. Which fellow representative would you want with you?
Oh my goodness. Wow, you're really. I just got elected. I'm going to already make 115 of my members unhappy. Wow. I had to think about that for a second. There's so many of them that I like that I couldn't choose. That's my political answer. I don't know. I mean, they're all. I mean, I have so many friends that I. I mean, think about who would be the most useful to me. Who would be like the person that could help me survive?
I hear Rusty Black and Chris Stefanelli are good at fishing.
Yeah, they're good fishers. That is true. I'm trying to think of who could live out in the wilderness that could provide me benefit there. I don't have to think about that for a second. I mean, give me a moment to think on that one. Go to the second question.
Okay, best ice cream.
Like to eat or flavor or what we specifically?
Oh, come on.
Well, I like Central Dairy and I like chocolate mint or mint chocolate chip. This is what my favorite
ice cream. But is Central Dairy's mint chocolate chip the best?
I would say yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I try to make a point to go there whenever I can. Although I'm trying to lose weight, so I can't do that now.
Yeah, just limit it to like once a week.
Right.
What is your favorite holiday tradition?
Usually it's Christmas, and my family, my side of the family, we get together, and where my parents live out in the country, there's a pretty good country road that's got a real steep hill, and if it's snowing, then we have a big toboggan, and so we go out and we go tobogganing on that big hill. So that's kind of been our tradition. The other tradition that we have on my side of the family is during Thanksgiving, if the weather is permissible, we have a paintball fight. We have our own little paintball field, and we have all of our equipment. So all the kids and grandkids are all out there. For a couple hours, we'll go out.
Is this a top notch paintball field?
It's pretty. It's pretty cool.
Covers and
it's got barriers. Oh yeah, we built it over the years. But we do the paintball thing with the family. So that's our other little tradition that we do on Thanksgiving.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It is, except when you get shot up close, then it kind of stings. But other than that, it's pretty fun.
So if you come back after Thanksgiving with a few bruises on your arms,
yeah, then you'll know why. That's why you got to be padded up pretty well.
May not have won that
round. It's better to play. It's better to do paintball in the wintertime because you can wear coats and stuff. So if you do get hit, it doesn't hurt near as bad as if you play paintball in the summertime. That can be pretty smart if you get hit up close. So.
Yeah.
Have you ever done paintballing?
I have not, but my brother used to all the time.
It's interesting. It's fun.
I don't trust myself around stuff like that. So thank you, Representative John Wieman, for joining us on the Hashtag MoLed podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We'll have to have you back sometime.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to the Hashtag MoLedge podcast. Next time, Rachel Dunn should be back with y'all.